are listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
So we're continuing our series called Anti-Heroes and Unsung Sidekicks. And today I'm not going to speak very long, but I'm going to speak on Peter, the disciple. So I'll start off with a bit of background on Peter, and then I'll jump into it. So the title of the sermon is Peter, Disciple, Denier, Defender. And I'll be mainly using the book of Mark, but also using a bit of Matthew just to capture some of the nuance between those shared stories. So these books cover a period of 3 to 4 years of Jesus' ministry in which Peter was involved. It's funny because sometimes when you read the books, or read the narratives, it almost seems like it's a week, like it's bang, 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 bang. That's really not the case. So this will kind of flow on from the understanding that these events happened over a course of time. So we'll start in Matthew 1:16, where Jesus is wandering around the Sea of Galilee, and he comes across a man named Simon, who would later be called Peter for the sermon, fishing with his brothers. Now, to begin with, there's actually some background context to this, because in the ancient Near East, the sea was seen as this mysterious, spiritual, terrifying thing. So the fact that they were fishing means they were broadly seen in society as brave and courageous. So these were ideas informing the professions that people hold. So when Jesus approached them, there was already an understanding that these were people who were willing to take brave and courageous decisions. So I'm sure there was a much bigger and broader conversation when he met them, but it's from this story that we get the line where Jesus says, "Come with me and I will make you fishers of men," or we relate it now as fishers of all people. And it said that they left their boats and their nets and they followed him. And already we're seeing some movement in the text with the beauty of the fishermen being seen as brave, but also the name Simon or Simeon in Aramaic, meaning to hear or to listen. So Jesus came around and they followed him. So they went with Jesus, and the first place they went to was Capernaum, which was quite close to the Sea of Galilee. And Jesus was an itinerant rabbi at the time, which meant he was moving from city to city, from town to town, preaching. And so they go there and he starts to preach and he starts to heal people, both from sickness and also possession, so demon possession. And I'm not going to go deep into the theology of that, but there are different perspectives on what that meant at the time. So the news starts to spread around Galilee of this itinerant preacher who is preaching powerful words. So following this, they head back to Simon's house. So Simon actually had a wife, but you don't hear much of her. Some historians believe they actually she travelled with Jesus and the disciples. Others believe that she may have stayed and caught up with them when they came back toward Galilee. So they're at Simon's house and Simon's mother-in-law is ill. So the first thing Jesus does is heal the mother-in-law at Simon's request. Then we hear that all the sick and possessed people in that town were brought to Jesus and they are healed. And he continues on preaching and healing around the surrounding towns. So we now jump forward a bit in the text. So it immediately follows, but historians believe it's roughly 18 months later that this occurs. So Simon declares that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. These are kind of theological claims around Jesus being the Messiah, Jesus being the one who will come and save and bring freedom and peace to Israel, but also to all people. So he's saying he believes that God is active and moving, and God is Jesus and is within Jesus. The other thing is that I grew up thinking Jesus Christ was like his last name, like kind of Matthew Harbin, so not Joel is Joel Holier, but that's not actually the case. The Christ is a title meaning Saviour or Messiah. So he's declaring that Jesus is more than a man, Jesus is one who has come to save. I think it's really important to note that because he's anointed to be the deliverer. So Jesus is anointed to deliver. And on this proclamation, Jesus decides to rename Simon Peter. In Greek, this is Petros or Petra, meaning rock. And then Jesus says, on this rock, I will build my ecclesia. And now that's the word we use for church, but at the time it contextually meant like an assembly, a gathering of people. And you'll hear pastors across the spectrum of belief often refer to the ecclesia because church is not a building, it's the people. But this was the understanding of what belief was from the get-go with Jesus. And so Paul also calls Peter Cephas, which is Aramaic for rock. So we see Jesus starting to establish Peter as this man on whom the church will start to be founded and start to be taught. And this is really an anchor point in the text of Mark and the text of Matthew. And everything in kind of the disciples' stories kind of pivots around this moment where there is a declaration of who Jesus is. And this is followed by Jesus himself claiming that he is God. And that's a really beautiful moment in the text that kind of I'm going to be speaking on now. So Jesus then starts teaching about how he is the Messiah. He starts teaching the early teachings around peace and love and forgiveness. And this is when he appoints the 12 disciples. And then they go out preaching together, and then they spread out across the ancient Near East. So after this, and again, we're looking now at about 2 years from the start of when Jesus started. That's when the persecution of Jesus begins. It starts with the officials starting to claim he is being blasphemous, claim he's being offensive by claiming he is the Messiah. But then it's Jesus' own family. His family pulls him aside and says, what are you doing? You're causing unrest. You need to stop. This is where we start to see the importance of Jesus' disciples. Now, it's often that we think about the disciples not as his friends, but as followers, as people who kind of worship him. Now, that's true, but this is also a group of close companions who traveled together for 3 years, who ate, laughed, cried together. They were close, they were friends, they believed the same things and were working toward the same goals. So these officials and even his own family start alleging that he is possessed or that Satan is using him. And he retorts this by saying, why would Satan drive out demons? So the 12 then continue preaching and healing, declaring that Jesus is the Messiah. And the key part of that is the idea that Jesus had given them the authority to heal. So we go from that, and in a nutshell, Jesus is accused of blasphemy, he is captured, and he's murdered. So that's the overview, but now I'm going to unpack Peter a little bit more. So when Peter announces that Jesus is the Messiah, the one who is to change everything, you start to see ideas shift. You start to see the formation of Christianity. So then we'll jump to Mark 6, which is a few months after Peter declares this. And I think everyone knows this story, but I'm not sure if people know the background behind it. So they're on a boat in a severe storm, and they're all starting to panic. So Jesus walks out on the water, and the disciples believe that it's a ghost. So Peter calls out to Jesus and says to Jesus, if it's you, let me walk toward you. And so he does. He gets out the boat, and he starts to walk. But then he starts to panic, he starts to doubt, and he starts to sink. And Jesus says to him, you have little faith, why did you doubt? And I think this is a really important caveat to the story, because growing up I was often taught of Jesus' words as angry, as you have little faith, why did you doubt? But that's not the Jesus we see. In fact, when you look at kind of the interlinear Greek and some of the translations, the text is a lot softer. This is not an angry, stoic Jesus. This is an encouraging, gentle, loving Jesus. And further to that, he's not saying, why don't you have faith in me? He's saying, why did you doubt yourself? Jesus had called him out upon the waters, and he doubted his own ability to do it because he didn't understand the authority and the power and the presence that he held because of Jesus. So through this, we can see that Jesus believed in Peter, and Peter was to do good works and amazing things through his authority. And this is what informed the 2 Corinthians verse, to walk by faith, not sight. And I think the message has a really beautiful framing of it, where Eugene Peterson writes, it's what we trust in but don't yet see which keeps us going. So there we see Peter kind of denying his own power and learning to trust himself over the process. So head back to Peter's declaration of Jesus as Messiah. He'd just become aware of a beautiful new promise of God at work in the world, restoring, redeeming, and bringing salvation. He was awakened to a new hope before him. Now, this notion of awakening is really central because it's where hope springs from. It's a new kind of love. It's a new countercultural belief in what the world can become. And it's through Jesus. So Peter is awake to this real big picture idea of who Jesus is and what can be done. And he spends his time working toward that. But then you jump to Mark 14 in the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus is deeply distressed and troubled. And again, go back to the point that Jesus is not stoic. Jesus is human, and he feels human emotions. And the future of death, the feelings of death, consumed him, and he was distressed and troubled. And so at this point, he asks his closest friends, those who are still with him, those few, to stay awake while he prays. He comes back after an hour, and they're asleep. And then his first response, again, is not judgment, but it's encouragement. He says to them, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Now, that's not an accusation. That's saying you have it in you to do what is required here, but just push a little harder. But he comes back again and finds them asleep again. Now, this time they're embarrassed, and the text says that they don't know what to say to Jesus. So he goes back and he prays again, and he comes back and they're asleep again. And he's particularly angry at Peter. Now, at this point, Jesus is fed up. Now, I know in my own life, I've had friends who haven't been there when I needed the most. They've disappeared, or they've hurt me, or they've stepped away. And I know everyone here probably has the same experience. That's what Jesus had gone through. When he needed Peter by his side, he failed not just once, but repeatedly. The man who was called to be a rock, to be someone who was sturdy, reliable, dependable, was more like a sandcastle which crumbled under pressure. And we'll continue on to Gethsemane because I think this part is really key as well. We find a really interesting detail where every writer captures a slightly different detail, which adds to whether John is arguing a theological standpoint or Luke is arguing a social justice standpoint. So we see the armed soldiers and officials come to arrest Jesus, and most of the texts say they're armed with swords and clubs. Now Peter impetuously pulls out a sword and strikes the ear of an official, cutting it off. Luke 22 records Jesus saying, no more of this, and then picking up the man's ear and healing it, which is a bit of a gross image, but it's again Jesus repeating this pattern of healing. So once again, under pressure, Peter fails. And he fails because this is a man who was beside Jesus for all the teachings, but notably the Sermon on the Mount, which was this wonderful teaching around a countercultural call to a new way of living, which was anti-violence, which was promoting peace and love and forgiveness. And again, I'll quote the message And Eugene Peterson quotes, references Matthew 28 as, love your enemies. Love your enemies. Let them bring out the best in you. This is what God does. He gives his best, his blessings, the sun to warm and the rain to nourish, to everyone regardless, the good and the bad, the nice and the nasty. So we see this beautiful message in the Sermon on the Mount, and then Peter cuts off the ear of the first enemy he encounters. So the enemy is struck with violence, and Peter is seen as a failure again. So now we come to the climax of the crucifixion, where just before, Peter had been recorded saying to Jesus, I will go with you, even unto prison and unto death. And yet, when push came to shove, he denied Jesus. Now, this is a moment where I'm standing back from the text, because it's very easy of me to go, oh, bad Peter, naughty, naughty, why did you deny Jesus? But the reality was his life was under threat. So this is where I think it's really important for us to see the denial of Jesus in the light of our humanness. But he does. He denies Jesus. And if you follow Matthew 26 and Mark 14, it's with increasing intensity each time. So the first time he says, I don't know what you're talking about. And then it said that he makes an oath. So he makes a promise that he does not know the man referring to Jesus. And the third time, he calls down the curses upon himself and again denies that he knows Jesus. Now, this doesn't mean he was swearing. It means he was saying things like, I don't know Jesus, and if I do, may I be struck down, that kind of thing. So you see this increasing intensity, which is not coming again out of a lack of faith, but a fear of the future. And then up into the rooster crows to signify Jesus, prophecy that he will deny him. And it said that Peter weeps bitterly. Now, obviously, the crucifixion is extremely important to Christianity, but I'm going to sweep over it for a second, because the next thing that happens, the next place we see Peter, is meeting the resurrected Jesus. So this is the real beauty of the text. After all of that, Jesus reveals himself to Peter. He shows himself. He shows Peter that he is still loved, that there is still a promise for him. Like, we don't live in a theology of, you know, lose yourself by M&M, where it's, you know, you only get one shot. We believe in a Trinity that is full of abundance. Not scarcity, but abundance. An abundance of grace, an abundance of love, and an abundance of peace. And with that as his foundation, Peter is able to again call upon the willing spirit which Jesus referred to and go on to do good works and found the church. I think that's really key, that we serve a God who is all about abundance. That Jesus can be seen as an anti-hero in the light of his failures, but Peter went on to do incredible things. And he did that in light of his salvation, in light of his authority, and in light of his knowledge of Jesus, who was redeeming all things. So I'm actually going to take a few steps back, because the other week, Joel preached on Samson, and I think this ties in really nicely to wrap this up. So Samson is a mess. So to begin with, Samson's beginnings are actually really similar to Jesus. So Samson's mother was told that he would be set apart, that he would be holy, that he would be someone who would lead Israel away from oppression. We'd call this proto-Messiah, or someone who has like messianic qualities. So Samson enters the story as an adult, and he is a judge. He's in the book of Judges. He is seen as a judge and a king of sorts. But wow, is he a failure. So we see Samson as he continually chooses lust in all its forms, lusting after power, lusting after women, lusting after governmental relations, really. And he continually chooses selfish desire and acts in ways that just don't have wisdom, that don't show love, that don't show mercy. Contrast those stories where Samson goes about from one place to another, from one situation to another, killing and killing and killing. Now compare that with Jesus, who goes about loving and healing, and loving and healing, and loving and healing. You have this contrast between chaos created out of power and peace, shalom created out of power. You have the story of a righteous, holy, loving king and judge in Jesus versus a selfish, hateful, violent king and judge in Samson. The other week, Joel also touched on this myth of redemptive violence, which is a theory by a guy called Renard, but is built on the theology of the Sermon on the Mount. And that is that Jesus teaches us that the cycle of violence and the belief that violence can end violence is a myth, that it's not true in reality, and it's certainly not true of God's love. And the beauty of what we see in that contrast is that even though there was darkness and there was horror, and we can't necessarily reconcile that within our own morality, God was still working in that space. It serves a contrast, and we see God doing his restoration through Israel being freed from oppression, partially through Samson's actions, right through to Jesus. So that's the God we worship. A God who is a righteous, loving judge, who does not believe in violence, who does not enact violence. And the other part of that is that Jesus teaches us that we are participating in this redemption and restoration, that we are part of the unfolding of his vision. He doesn't hold our sins against us, and he's moving us towards something more beautiful. So imagine everyone here knows who Martin Luther King is. He was a civil rights activist from the 1670s. So Martin Luther King was really heavily influenced by a theologian called Theodore Parker. And you may have heard a condensed version of this quote, but I'll read a longer version. Theodore Parker said, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. I cannot calculate by the experience of sight, but I can divine it by my conscience. And from what I can see, I'm sure it bends towards justice." Now, I fundamentally believe this, but I also don't believe it's kind of happening out there. I believe it's happening within us and amongst us and through us with the teachings and the power of Jesus. So Parker went on to give the example that we are blessed by enacting justice in ourselves, and this is all contributing to a collective justice around the world. And it's from our little acts of justice, our small acts of kindness, that seeds can be sown for Jesus to do greater work. Individual and collective restoration, small and large restoration. He also uses the phrase that even the crumbs of the table of loving kindness may save someone's life. So Martin Luther King was preaching that theology of restoration and hope and beauty 63 years ago, inspired by Parker 180 years ago, was inspired by another guy 200 years ago, he was inspired by a Christian philosopher 350 years ago, right back to a rooster crowing. Right back to a man named Peter declaring that Jesus the King reigns in healing rather than death, in love rather than hate, and restoration rather than chaos. Right back to a God who created beauty and wonder from the dust. And the wonder of this is that all of creation, all of history, is woven together by this loving God. We are all part of this tapestry of the God enacting that restoration, in which we get the privilege and in some ways the terror of participating. But the beauty of community, the beauty of the words of Jesus, is that we all get to be part of it. And we do. We saw the Future Conference. Now we hear the stories of the social workers and the teachers and the charity workers and the various people around this community all do beautiful things to enact that love. And friends, that is the gospel. That is the good news of Jesus Christ that we get to participate in. So may you go into this week in the knowledge that you are loved. May you go into this week knowing you are God's masterpiece, God's workmanship as part of a tapestry. And may you continually participate in the unfolding, healing, and restoration, even when it's beyond our sight, even when it's a long way beyond our sight. But it may be just ahead. It may be that we get to plant the seeds of trees that we never see grow. And may you deeply, deeply know grace and peace and hope and love on every step of the way.